Good morning. We are talking today about rebellion. The last few weeks we have covered God's covenant with Abraham, and then, of course, through his children, Isaac and Jacob. We've talked about the institution of the blood sacrifice, which took place at Passover. And then last week we talked about the law. Oh, man. You know, any of you ever had one of those days when you actually wondered why you do what you do? I just had one of those in real time right there. Okay. We talked about the law last week, the giving of the law. So in this theme of the road to redemption, we're going to talk about, obviously, not just what God is doing in this time, but how God's people respond, because that is kind of a parallel narrative that needs to be addressed. And so today we're talking about the children of Israel and rebellion, and we're going to be using a text from the book of Numbers, chapter 13. We're going to be looking at the end of 13 and the beginning of chapter 14 as we get into this. Now, one of the things that is really important from a contextual standpoint is, as we get to this story, it's important to understand what the children of Israel, who, by the way, in their time in Egypt, did not have, as far as we know from Scripture, did not have a tremendous amount of contact with God. We know that God spoke to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. But outside of that, we don't really know how much contact he had with the children of Israel. So the Scripture doesn't really speak to that. So it certainly seems like, from a scriptural standpoint, that the children of Israel had not had a tremendous amount of contact with God in the 400 years that they were enslaved in Egypt. So it's easy to understand, it's easy to see why the children of Israel would not have a tremendous amount of knowledge of God. And so as they come out of Egypt, they have witnessed the 10 plagues, okay? And try to imagine seeing those plagues take place in real time. And then they have obviously witnessed the 10th plague, the Passover, the angel of death that went through Egypt. They have seen the Red Sea parted so that they could escape the armies of Pharaoh. They have seen the pillar of light that has led them to Mount Sinai. So they have seen God's presence. So they've witnessed all this stuff firsthand. And now they have left Mount Sinai, where they received the law, and they are now standing at the entrance to the land that was promised them by covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they are standing there getting ready to take it. And so at this point, they have sent spies. Moses has sent spies into the land of Canaan to spy it out and to bring back a report, and that's where we're going to pick up today in the book of Judges, chapter 13, verse 25. It says, when they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days. It's always 40 days. So 40 days they spied out the land. They proceeded to come to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness. So this massive crowd of people have gathered to hear the report of the spies. It says, and they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. So they've actually gone, they have taken samples of the things that were growing there and they've brought them back. And so now it says, thus they told him and said, we went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey. And this is its fruit. So they've got the samples, whatever they didn't eat. Nevertheless, and by the way, there's always a nevertheless, isn't there? By the way, that is King James for but. But the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Now, for those of you who don't know, Anak was a giant. He was a descendant of the Rephaim. So there were giants in the land. And if you're going really giants, remember, we're talking about Goliath, It's people. So there are those people in the land. And it says Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Jordan. Now, as you hear this report, you kind of wonder, did they expect to come and find the place empty? Is that what they were expecting? Now, as you start to hear the report of the spies and you start to think about what they're saying, there's a tremendous amount of parallelism as we look at how we interpret Scripture and how we see our place in the kingdom. How many of you, when you became Christians, were under the delusion that once you did that, it would be an easy path to heaven? How many of you thought that? Probably more of you than want to admit. Probably a lot of us, you know, because a lot of us became Christians when we were young, and we just thought, oh, well, this is going to be a piece of cake, right? I mean, now I've gotten baptized, I'm a Christian now, but it's a straight shot to eternity. This is going to be a piece of cake. How many of you have found that it doesn't work that way? Right. It's a little more complicated than that. And there's a tremendous amount of parallel between what we experience in our relationship with God and what happens to the children of Israel. They think the hard part's over, right? The hard part was getting out of Egypt. That was the hard part. We got out of Egypt. We've gone to Mount Sinai, and there was water, and we've had food, and we got the law, and that was all the hard part. And now we're just going to walk into the promised land, and we're going to get there, and it'll be empty. Everybody, you know, people just get up and leave because we're coming, and we'll walk in, and there'll be houses and farms that are just ready for us to move into. And that's very much how I think we tend to think about eternity. It's like, oh, well, I've become a Christian now, and so now I'm just gonna wander through this life, and it's gonna be easy. It's not gonna take any effort. It's not gonna take any commitment. It's not gonna require any sacrifice on my part. I'm just gonna walk in, and there it's gonna be. Now, one of the things that becomes critical in this is what happens to us when we meet resistance. Now, any of you ever encountered the classic bully, the person who's really tough until somebody actually stands up to him? You've probably seen some of those people. I think a lot of us are probably really confident. When I was growing up, we had a there were certain guys that when we had ball practice, whether it was football or baseball, I was too short to play basketball in high school. But when you know, you get in practice, and there were guys who, when they were in practice, they were all American athletes in practice. You know what I'm talking about? Those guys would get into practice when there was nobody watching, and there was no pressure, and there were no fans in the stands, and they would kill it. And then they would get to a game when it mattered, when people were watching, when someone was actually trying to stop you, and they would just collapse under the pressure. Any of you ever felt that? You know, if any of you have ever shot basketball, you walk in a gym when there's nobody there and you shoot free throws, and you're like, this is easy. I don't know why guys can't shoot 90% from the free throw. This is easy. And then you get in the game, and everybody's yelling and screaming at you, and the fans are cheering, and the shots matter. And all of a sudden, that shot's not as easy. So most of us in this room probably have some experience, whether it's through athletics or through a job. I remember the first time somebody asked me to serve communion. I was like 13, 14 years old. Now, I grew up in the church. My dad was a preacher. How many times do you think I had seen communion served in a church in my life? Well, you can go ahead and multiply 13 times 52 if you're so inclined. That's how many times I'd seen it. Because I didn't ever miss church, because, you know, back in the day, they'd drag you to church if you had the flu, just keep you away from the other kids. Shannon's going, yeah, she knows, preacher's kid, she gets it. So I'd seen it a million times, right? So guess what happened the Sunday they asked me to do it? I couldn't remember how to do it. Now, how is it possible that you could watch communion served every Sunday your whole life, and then when you get asked to do it, you get up there and you're like, what am I supposed to do? There's a big difference in watching it and doing it, right? It's a big difference. So here we get to this critical moment where the children of Israel think that the hard part is over. They think now we're just going to walk in. And so as the spies start to talk about all the big bad people that live in the promised land, Caleb, the spy, not my son. That's just who my son's named after. Caleb the spy. By the way, happy birthday, Caleb. Listen to what happens in verse 30. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses. Now remember, he was one of the spies. He quiets everybody down. And he says, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. Don't you hate the optimist? There's always that guy, right? This, oh, this is nothing. We can do this. Caleb is all excited, man. He's like, look, I didn't leave Egypt to come up here and turn around. We got here. We can do this. Let's go take possession of it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land, which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There we also saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. So here we get to this critical moment where the children of Israel have reached the border of what that had been promised them in this covenant with their ancestor Abraham. And Abraham had said, your descendants will possess this land. They will control this land. This is going to be for them. And so now we are at the culmination of the covenant. Now, I want to take you back to last week, which is even more necessary since only three people remembered what the sermon was on last week. So if you remember, when the law was given to the children of Israel, when they told Moses to tell God, we will be your people, we will keep this covenant. Remember, they told him that. This is, we will keep this covenant. The covenant will be ours. We will follow the law. We want the covenant. So now we reach this critical moment, and Caleb gets up and says, guys, this is what we left Egypt for. This is what our ancestors were promised. God is with us. The God who brought the 10 plagues on Egypt, you saw what he did to them, and the God who opened the Red Sea and let us pass through, and the God who's done all these amazing things, whose presence we saw on the mountain, who gave us the law, he is with us, he's telling us to go get it, let's go get it. Now, I want to take a moment and stop right there for those of you who are being incredibly judgmental towards the children of Israel right now, which is probably everyone in this room is in there going, yeah, man, those guys were stupid. I mean, God had made all these promises to them. They had seen his power. And yet when the critical time came, what did they do? Nothing. Now, let me ask you a question. How much does that sound like the modern church? Right? We've seen all the things that God has done. He has already told us that we're going to win. We're going to be victorious. We don't have anything to fear. Get out there and look, get out there and do your thing. Get out there and evangelize, witness. You go do your thing. I've already promised the victory. Go get it. And then we look out in a world that is critical of our beliefs, who is hostile to our faith, people who are clearly enemies of what we believe. Sounds a lot like the people inhabiting the promised land. And here we are, and there is resistance in front of us, and what do? Nothing. Nothing. We meet the resistance that's in front of us, and we go, oh, well, I wasn't expecting resistance. I thought this was just going to be, I thought it was going to be given to me. Let me ask you a question. How many of you remember growing up in a nation that you at least believed was a Christian nation? Any of you remember that? Okay. How many of you think it's still a Christian nation? Now, here's the question. Why? Why isn't it? Because we did nothing, right? We didn't do anything. We let this happen. And some people say, well, Stuart, that's a little harsh. Well, sometimes harsh is true. If our nation isn't Christian anymore, who does that fall at the feet of? It falls at the feet of the church, right? Because we got complacent, we got lazy, we got comfortable. Oh, well, this, you know, hey, things are pretty good like they are. And, you know, I didn't sign up to do work. I signed up to be saved. I didn't sign up to do work. And man, don't we sound like the children of Israel. I didn't sign up to fight for the promised land. I just didn't want to be a slave anymore. God freed them from Egypt. He's freed us from sin. And now, what do I want to do? Do I want to work? No, I don't want to work. I want to coast into heaven, just like they wanted to coast into the promised land. But guess what? That's not the way it works. That's not the way it works. And so we find ourselves, I think really, as individuals, we frequently find ourselves at the exact same crossroads that the children of Israel found themselves at. We are standing here and we are looking at what was promised us, but there is an obstacle, in fact, several, in our way. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Caleb stands up and says, let's go get it. It's ours. It's been promised to us. We've seen what God can do. We can take possession of this thing. Let's go. And then the other spies are like, easy now. Easy. Do we need to tell you who's there? The Amalekites are there. The Hittites are there. The Amorites are there. The Jebusites are there. The Anakim, the giants are there. They've got fortified cities, Caleb. And he's like, I don't care. Now let's flip over to Numbers chapter 14, verse 1, because we're going to kind of see how this thing plays out. Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. Now, why are they crying? This is an interesting verse, right? The people wept all night. What are they crying about? They're disappointed. We got here expecting a cupcake. You know, we thought we were just going to walk in here, kind of like Alabama at LSU yesterday. You know, we just showed up expecting a cupcake. Nobody told us the cupcake had teeth. I'm sorry, I couldn't pass that up for all my friends who love Bama, all three of them. But, you know, sometimes you just can't pass stuff up. All right, so they're crying because, you know, it's like, oh, what we've left Egypt, and we've come all the way here, and now look at what's happened. It says, all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron because Moses and Aaron put those people in the promised land, right? So they grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, now I want you to listen carefully to this because this is such a critical concept in this road to redemption we're talking about. The whole congregation said to them, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to turn around and go back to Egypt? So they said to one another, this is fantastic. They said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. Now, I want you to take a minute and think about what these people are saying. They have just left Egypt in smoldering ruins, right? I mean, they've seen the army of Egypt washed into the Red Sea. What do you suppose is going to happen to these people if they go back? What do you think the Egyptians will do as soon as they see them? They're going to kill them. They're going to kill them. Now, so let me ask you a question. What motivates people to want to go back into slavery? Fear. Fear of what? The unknown? Fear of what's out there? One of the more interesting things is, as a guy who teaches American history, is you go back and look at the period right after the Civil War, the number of freed slaves who never left the plantation. It's startling. If you go back and look at the number of slaves who were freed and now had no money, no just the clothes on their back, they didn't have food, they didn't have anything, and so not knowing where to go or what to do, they stayed. They stayed. So it's an interesting thing, right? That when we are freed, sometimes when we're freed and then we're facing the unknown, fear drives us right back into that from which we were freed. And if I ask you today as individuals, if I said, here's what I would like you to do today. I'd like you to go home after church and I'd like you to pray this prayer. Lord, whatever you want me to do tomorrow, make it clear and I'll do it. Now, how many of you have the guts to pray that? And the answer is most of us probably don't. I don't even know. I'm not even sure I do. And why would we be afraid to pray that? Well, what are we afraid of? Well, what might he ask me to do? What if he wants me to go overseas and be a missionary? I don't want to do that. What if he wants me to quit the job I have and go do something? What if he wants me to go into ministry? What if he wants me to be more evangelistic to my friends who don't even know I'm a Christian because I don't want to be embarrassed? What if he wants me to do something hard? Fear of the unknown makes us rebellious, right? We rebel against God's will because we don't know what he might ask us to do. We don't know what's on the other side of the river. We don't know what we're going to encounter when we get into the promised land. And because we think we know what's going to happen, here's what we'd rather do. Hey, Moses, Aaron, we hate you guys. What we need to do is vote us a new leader and go back to Egypt. And you know why we want to go back to Egypt? There's a great old saying, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't, right? The devil you know is better than the devil you don't. We know what was in Egypt. We were slaves there, but at least we were alive. We didn't die there, which is kind of not true because some of them did. But we know what that was. We know what that was. And as miserable as it was comfortable and it was safe and it was known. So we would rather go back into that than to face the unknown because we're afraid. And the irony of that is today, 2,000 plus years after that happened, 3,500 years later, we sit in comfortable, air-conditioned churches in a country that experiences immense amounts of freedom, and we judge those people, don't we? What a bunch of losers. How stupid were they? What kind of idiot would get freed from slavery in Egypt and then facing the land that had been promised to them by God, turn around and go back to it? How stupid are they? And then we look in the mirror at the person who was freed from sin and was told to go out, great commission, go out and do your job. And how many of us would rather turn around and go back into the sin we were freed from than go into the unknown and do what we were told to do? That question hurts, doesn't it? That hurts. Because when we look at those people, by the way, have you ever noticed how easy it is to judge other people as opposed to judging yourself? I mean, you remember that time when Jesus told those people, hey, here, let me give you a suggestion. Get the plank out of your own eye before you start trying to get the speck of dust out of somebody else's. By the way, it's always a good idea not to let somebody with a beam sticking out of their eye try to get your contact lens in. Just a little safety tip there for you. But I mean, that's what this whole story is about, right? The road to redemption is littered with people who have run out of gas, pulled off on the side of the road, or turned around and headed back the other way. Right? And we sit there and go, why? Why would anybody do that? Why would you go back into the mess that you'd been rescued from? God rescued those people from slavery, and he's trying to give them this incredible land, and they were too scared to take it. And yet, we are such a parallel of them. And it doesn't even occur to us how much of a parallel we can be sometimes, that God has freed us, paid an incredible price to free us from a life of sin. And then he says, now, go collect what I've promised you. Get out there and do it. Here's the obstacle that is between you and salvation. And here's the irony. Most of us think becoming a Christian was the obstacle, right? That's what most of us think. Is that once I became a Christian, that was the last hurdle. That was the last obstacle. Now it's just smooth sailing. By the way, do you think anybody walked out of Egypt going, whew, I'm glad the worst of it's over? You guys remember when they were at the banks of the Red Sea and they looked off in the distance and they saw Pharaoh's army coming? By the way, does any of you happen to remember that story well enough to know what they wanted to do there? They wanted to kill Moses and turn around and go back. This is not the first time they've done this. Every time they met an obstacle, every time they met some challenge, their instinct was to do what? I'm going to quit and we're going to go back. Now, let me ask you a question. Let's think of this on a more personal level, than more of a micro level than a macro level. Let's think of this more of a personal sense. How many times has Satan attacked you and your solution to that problem was to get mad at God and stomp out of the room? Have you ever done that? Any of you had a little personal moment where you threw a little tantrum because Satan did something? Satan attacked you and you got mad and stomped your feet and walked out? Any of you ever done that? I've done it. I seriously doubt I'm the only person in this room that's done it. See, we see them on a macro level. We see the children of Israel as a group, but you think about us individually and how Satan is constantly dropping obstacles in front of us. I guess the analogy that would really work here is that the road to redemption is full of potholes, right? Lots of potholes on the road to redemption. Lots of broken down cars and debris. There's a lot of stuff in the way that we have to maneuver around and sometimes maneuver through. And so these people, as they stand at this critical moment, their solution was, you know what, we're going to turn around and we're going to go home. Verse 5. I want you to listen to Moses' reaction to this. It says, Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly, the congregation of the sons of Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregations of the sons of Israel, saying, the land which we passed through to spy out is exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us. Boy, that's always the critical statement, isn't it? If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. By the way, how do they know that he'll do that? Because he promised he would, right? That's the covenant. That was the covenant deal. That was the arrangement. He already told them how this thing is going to end. This is what's going to happen. Only do not rebel against the Lord and do not fear the people of the land. This is a great line. For they will be our prey. Boy, there's a big difference, isn't there, in being the hunter and the hunted. Right? There's a big difference. This just kind of popped in my head. I apologize. Sometimes I segue unintentionally. But there's this great verse that talks about the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Did you know that most commentaries say that that translation is not correct? It doesn't say that the gates of hell will not prevail against it. It says the gates of hell will not withstand it. Now, let me ask you a question. What's the difference in those two statements? It's like, well, Stuart, it's the same thing. No, it is totally not the same thing. When it says the gates of hell will not prevail against it, it means that the church is on the defensive and won't fall. When it says the gates of hell shall not stand against it, it means the church is on the offensive and hell's gates will fall to the power of the church. Two totally different concepts. There is a big difference in tag in being the chaser and the chasee. Right? They look at the children of Israel and go, guys, we will not be their prey. They will be ours. Only do not rebel against the Lord and do not fear the people of this land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them. And the Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Now, let me ask you a question. How many of you feel like when you get up in the morning and walk out the house, how many of you feel like you are immediately on the defensive and how many feel like you are going out to conquer? Paul says we will be more than what? Conquerors, right? We'll be more than conquerors. We have adopted this mindset in the church which is totally flawed and totally backwards, which is we spend our entire life on the defensive from Satan. And there's nothing biblical about that at all. We are the victors. Hasn't that already been promised in God's covenant with us? When you became a Christian, what was the covenant you entered into with God? If you would be faithful unto death, I will give you what? Crown of life, right? So they said their protection's been removed from them. The Lord is with us. Do not fear them. But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. So when the children of Israel heard this yakety yak from Caleb and Joshua, the congregation of Israel said, let's stone them. We're going to replace them. We're going back to Egypt. And then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting to all the sons of Israel. Now, I'm gonna blow the ending of this for you, for those of you who we're going to go home and read to see how this ends. Every man and woman who stood there that day and refused to enter the promised land died in the wilderness, wandering for the next 40 years. None of them got in to the promised land. By the way, including Moses and Aaron. In fact, two people above the age of 20 entered the promised land that were 20 years old on the day all this happened. Guess who they were? Joshua and Caleb. Every other adult that stood there that day and made the decision they made, every other adult died because of their own failure to trust God. Their fear made them rebel, and the price was their life and the covenant, because they rejected the covenant. So this morning, as the praise team comes to lead us in our time of communion, I want to ask you a very simple question about how you perceive yourself as it pertains to this story. Are you the prey or the predator? It's a pretty simple question, isn't it? Are you the prey or the predator? Do you fear Satan, or does Satan fear you? Do you trust God enough to take what he's promised you and to live faithfully and overcome your fear, overcome the obstacles that are in front of you, and go out there and do what is necessary? Now, I want to be clear about something. In the wars that took place 40 years in the future, when Joshua led the children of Israel into the promised land, guess what? Some Israelites died. They did. I mean, that's the nature of war. It's the nature of battle. Some of them died. But they died in the land that had been promised them as their inheritance. Okay? They didn't die wandering in the wilderness. They died in the land that had been promised them. Our inheritance is not a physical place. It's eternal. If you go out tomorrow and do the stuff God wants you to do, might there be some consequences? Might there be some casualties? Yeah, I think it would be foolish to suggest to you, hey, look, you go out and do what you do, and he's going to work it all out so there's no obstacles. Remember, all the disciples died. All the 12 died. Paul died. Stephen died. I mean, it's not hard to go through and list the martyrs in the New Testament. We understand that. Difficulties are real, and they're tangible, and they're out there. But God says, guys, don't be afraid of that. Jesus, in the book of Matthew, said, do not fear the one who can take your life. Fear the one who can take your soul. What is at stake in our battle between faith and fear is our soul. And so we should be mindful of that. It's not our nation. It's not, you know, we think of all the things that we think, man, if we just were more faithful, this is how this would work. It really comes down to a simple thing. What is at stake in the battle between fear and faith is your soul. Be the predator, not the prey.